This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Our guest is Julian Zelizer. He is a professor of history and also not only a staple at Princeton University, an accomplished author, and he has written about one of the important figures in our time, Newt Gingrich, the former House Speaker who spent a lot of quality time during the Vietnam War piling up degrees at Tulane University. And he, of course, changed the world in 1994 when the Republicans took control of the House. And the book is Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker and the Rise of the New Republican Party. Today's New York Times has a nice review of Julian's work. And good morning to you, Julian Zelizer.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
877-217-5757 is your number. You note that Gingrich, before he dabbled in politics successfully in Georgia, tried and failed as an academic career. He wanted to be a historian like you, didn't he?
It's true. He received his Ph.D. in history at Tulane, and he went to his first job, which was at West Georgia College. It would be his only academic job. He'd go into politics. But initially, that's what he set out to do. And I think in some ways, I argue in the book, it might explain some of how he thought of politics, meaning he was interested in telling a story and spinning a narrative for voters. But that wasn't the future of his career, meaning academia.
Well, he took down a party in 1994, and he took down a man in Jim Wright, who was a long institutionalized person in the House. And when I say institutionalist, I mean somebody who was considered part of the House forevermore. And Jim Wright went down on things that today would be probably less egregious than they were then. There was the banking scandal. And, of course, Gingrich had also bounced checks at the House bank. And there was a book scandal. And, of course, Gingrich had done the same thing that Jim Wright did, getting supporters to buy his books. So how did Newt pull this off?
Yeah, Gingrich was very good. He took stories in the press that had come out from hardworking investigative journalists, which raised some questions about Jim Wright, who became Speaker in 1987. And there were some questions about the fact he sold books of speeches in bulk to groups when he appeared before them, or he had been in business legally with a real estate developer in his district. There weren't any stories that were actually that unusual compared to what was going on with other members. And Gingrich himself had a book deal that he was under investigation for. But Gingrich was pretty masterful at kind of whipping up a frenzy in Washington and using the media to blow this up into something very grandiose. And he would call Jim Wright all the time the most corrupt speaker in American history before anything was really proven. And it was effective. I mean, it launched an investigation by the Ethics Committee. It scared Democrats, and it achieved its goal.
877-217-5757, if you'd like to get under the wire with Julian Zelizer. His book is Burning Down the House, getting magnificent reviews. Today in the New York Times, in the review that is in the Section C, it says, so much that's associated with the Republican Party under Trump, Zelizer argues, the rowdiness, the bare-knuckle name-calling, the white-knuckle clinging to power at all costs dates back to Gingrich's ascent in the late 80s. Gingrich went from being a junior member of Congress on the fringes of the minority party to the center of Republican leadership by destroying the long legislative career of Jim Wright, the Democratic Speaker of the House. Now, some of the ways he did this were available to him that had not been available to others, like C-SPAN. But at the time, nobody knew that C-SPAN could pack a wallop, but it did. How did Newt have the vision to accomplish what he did?
It was a skill. He saw how he could capitalize on new elements of the media in Washington to his advantage. C-SPAN was a channel that just went on the air in 1979. The House had just allowed itself to be covered by cameras. And so Gingrich had an aha moment and said, anyone's allowed in the House to get up and make speeches at the end of the day. And in 1984, he and his allies went on air every day and at the end of the day made these speeches saying Democrats are weak on defense, Democrats won't support Ronald Reagan's war against communism. And they'd say, do you have a response? They'd ask specific Democrats. But if you were watching C-SPAN, you couldn't see the chamber was empty at that time of the day. There was no one there. There was no one to respond. And it turns into a big controversy, but it is a way in which Gingrich gets his attacks out there and his arguments out there. And he's very savvy in terms of how the media is changing in the 80s. And he uses that as a platform before he's a leader in the party to get this message about a corrupt Democratic establishment out to voters.
David in St. Francisville, you're on the air. Good morning to you. You're on with Julian Zelizer.
Yes, sir. I have a son-in-law who is a history professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And he shared with me a notebook that Gingrich kept, a legal pad, all the different notes that he made. And one of the main things that he said his objective was to make the Democrats the party of big government.
All right. I don't know if you could hear David, but he said he had a relative who's an academician, as you are, you who had a notebook that was Gingrich's, who said that Gingrich wanted to make the Democrats the party of big government. Was that a big part of his mantra?
It was, although that was a more familiar part of the Republican lexicon. I think that was certainly part of what Gingrich would reiterate and talk about all the time. But I think more important to him was the argument that the Democrats were a corrupt establishment, that they were somehow keeping power through artificial and unfair means. And he thought that in some ways would allow him to build a much broader base of support, because in the post-Watergate, post-Vietnam era, when many people distrusted government, that was an argument that he could present himself as a conservative populist, not by talking about right, left, liberal, conservative, but about why the system had to be fixed and why the leaders had to be toppled. So I'd say that was even more important for Gingrich and more unique to his brand of conservatism than Ronald Reagan.
Now, Gingrich also tore into President Clinton in the Lewinsky scandal. And as it turned out, he was having an affair with an aide himself who would become his third wife, who later became ambassador to the Vatican. Interesting that he could put blinders on when it came to his own transgressions while pointing the finger at others for doing exactly the same thing.
Well, I think there's stories like this throughout his career. He's often doing exactly what he's accusing others of. And I think it, for many, it points to the sense that he didn't really care about the issues he was talking about, that the ethical issues, the personal issues, these were means to an end. He is someone who thought partisanship was the single priority for Republican elected officials, and they always had to act according to what would win the party power. And so that's why he lobbed all these issues against the opponents. But the fact he was guilty of many of these transgressions at the time really undercuts any sense that he profoundly was bothered by seeing this in Washington.
Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on with Julian.
Yes. Did Gingrich's success also depend on a listening public more aware of the goings-on of the Kardashians than who their own congressman was?
Was he able to play into the American inability to get nuances of serious matters and be fascinated with less serious matters?
It's not a bad argument. I mean, he did understand that, and he at least saw politics as a form of entertainment. And he would say all the time that for politicians to get on the media, you couldn't talk about substance and the details of legislation. He would say, you have to give the press more Indiana Jones than Philharmonic, more of a thriller and confrontation than serious stuff. And I think that worked in part because, yes, your caller's right. That's what a lot of the public wanted. And that's the kind of entertainment they consumed and have consumed ever since. And I think a lot of the news shifts to that kind of substance. And Gingrich played directly to that, and it got him lots of attention.
Well, years from now, people will be writing about Newton Leroy Gingrich. He was a major figure at the latter part of the 20th century. Bill Clinton, though, ultimately, he won the day. He kept his job, and Gingrich and Bob Livingston didn't. It was an amazing turn of events, wasn't it?
It was fitting in many ways, Shakespearean, that the guy who launches his career by bringing down a speaker in 1989, about a decade later, as speaker, would fall from power himself, and that his own problems and his own personal issues would be the reason for his downfall. And many of his opponents outlasted him. Gingrich never went on to win the presidency. He ran, doesn't become Trump's vice presidential pick. But I think where he probably gets satisfaction at some level is watching the world that he spun of partisanship become the norm in Washington. And I think there's a reason he's very enamored with the Trump presidency and writes about it all the time. This is the world he helped create.
Well, thank you, Julian Zelizer. The book is Burning Down the House, important book about American politics. It's been a pleasure, sir. Congratulations.
Thanks for having me.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757, 117 shopping days away from the presidential election and lots of other elections. And by the way, we do have an election this Saturday. Many things are on the ballot locally, including the mayor's office in Baker, and we will feature the three candidates tomorrow on this show. President Trump's banks and accounting firms must turn over his financial records to Manhattan prosecutors. That from the United States Supreme Court. This ruling just took place. A stinging loss for the president, who has fought relentlessly to keep those records secret. Manhattan prosecutor Cyrus Vance subpoenaed 8 years' worth of the president's tax returns as part of an investigation into hush money payments made to Baton Rouge native Stormy Daniels during the 2016 election. The president challenged those subpoenas as unlawful, but the court rejected that argument, ordering financial institutions to comply with Vance's subpoenas. Vance subpoenaed those records as part of a secret grand jury process, so he likely cannot make them public before the election. The Supreme Court will also rule today on separate subpoenas issued by a trio of House committees. So a stinging blow, perhaps the biggest blow politically to the president in his 4 years in office, almost 4 years in office. 877-217-5757 is your number. We should have Mark Ballard joining us shortly, but Miriam in South Baton Rouge. Miriam, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana. Can you pull Miriam up, Matt? There we go.
Hi.
Hi, Miriam.
I had a comment about Newt Gingrich because I went to school with his baby sister, Candace, who when he started to run for office, she had to come out publicly as a lesbian in order so that it wouldn't come out as a scandal with him.
Who had to come out? Who had to come out?
His baby sister.
Okay. All right. Now, who was responsible for that?
Because he was running for office at the time.
Yes, and so.
This was not a time or good time for most people to come out as a lesbian.
No, not at all. But who was the one who outed her? Was it Gingrich or was it somebody else?
She outed herself.
Okay.
She came out to the family first, and then she came out publicly.
Did she?
And I know she's head of some big gay and lesbian organization in D.C. now.
Well, if you remember Gingrich in 1993, before he became speaker, and it was one of the things he used, of course, in 94 in the election to just hammer away at Clinton, was that he called Clinton a draft dodger. Of course, he was a draft dodger himself. I think he even called Clinton fat. And looking at Gingrich now, the guy's at least 100 pounds overweight. But nonetheless, he used the gays in the military thing against Clinton. And he used it effectively, and it is interesting that his sister, you point out, is gay. But what is the point you're trying to make about this, that it was unfair to his sister?
Yes.
Well, and yes, indeed. It's unfortunate that people who were caught in the crossfire, just family members with nothing more than being family members, and sometimes are tarred unfairly, and in some cases, there have been cases in which a reporting has been inaccurate. I could do a show on that, and perhaps we will at some point. But thank you so much, Miriam. Appreciate your comments. 877-217-5757 is your number. And we're going to go to Mark Ballard, but we did have David in Atlanta who's been waiting patiently, and I want to get David on, and he probably has something for Mark. But, David, good morning to you.
You know, I remember when Newt Gingrich was paid by a savings and loan for a book deal, and then Newt Gingrich ran Jim Wright, the Democratic Jim Wright was paid by a savings and loan for a book deal, and Newt Gingrich ran Jim Wright, the Democratic Speaker, out of the House of Representatives, forced him into retirement, and then Newt Gingrich comes along and makes a book deal with Rupert Murdoch, which was, I think, a scandal in and of itself. So what a hypocrite Gingrich is.
Well, Mark Ballard is with us. I think he's been listening to this, and hypocrisy in politics seems to be synonymous with just about anybody who's a participant. As Jerry Brown says, it's only a matter of degree, but Newt Gingrich, the pride of Tulane University, brought it to a new level, Mark Ballard.
Well, I used to think I was cynical before I took this job, and I realized, no, I'm not cynical nearly enough because, I mean, that's kind of what goes on with politics.
Well, and the fact that Gingrich did almost all of the things he accused others of doing and sometimes did it more flamboyantly. Three marriages for Gingrich, by the way, who was attacking Clinton, an affair with a woman who on his staff while he was criticizing, and Clinton certainly deserved the criticism, but Gingrich would have seemed the least likely guy to have any credibility, but it worked for a while. But ultimately, Gingrich went by the wayside, and Clinton stayed. And I think historians will remember Clinton, despite the Lewinsky impeachment proceedings, which were successful in the House. We'll remember him as a good president and remember Gingrich as probably a so-so at best Speaker of the House.
Probably so. But Gingrich did bring in this very kind of aggressive conservative partisanship to politics on the D.C. level. I mean, it had been there for a while, but he had made it just normal, I guess.
Normal, and he used the new medium. He knew at the time it was C-SPAN. He used it to great effect, just as the president has mastered Twitter. He's able to basically change the course of the conversation as he wishes by virtue of his tweets each day.
And and he's able to do that because we follow those tweets. He's the president, so we follow those tweets. It becomes the news of the day.
877-217-5757 for Mark Ballard. And in case you missed it, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the president must send his tax returns to the DA in New York City, Cyrus Vance. And it probably means he'll also have to turn them over to Congress. As we know, these things are hard to keep secret, even though they're supposed to stay secret. This is a stinging blow for the president. He's been able to delay, but it seems now he has met the end of the trail on this, and it'll be fascinating to see how this shakes out, Mark.
I agree totally. I think we're going to find out he's not a billionaire and that he didn't pay a whole lot of taxes, took advantage of a lot of tax breaks.
Well, he's a guy who has managed to have great success. He did get elected president of the United States, and he went from never running for office and went for the highest office in the world, and he achieved that. And for those who discount him, I think they do so foolishly. I think it's highly improbable, Mark, and we will segue after the break, but we will segue to the Louisiana matters. But it's highly improbable that he will win the overall vote. He'll lose probably many more votes than he did in 2016, but he could win in the Electoral College. That is still a possibility.
Yeah, I have not discounted him at all. I think we have a better and even chance of a second term.
You and I are old enough to remember Geraldine Ferraro. She was the first woman on a ticket in 1984 with Walter Mondale, congresswoman from New York. He carried one state. And then John McCain lost by 10 million votes to Barack Obama when he chose Sarah Palin. Biden has said it will be a woman. Will he fare better? And who's out there? Who do you think the ultimate choice will be?
Well, I kind of think that we'll be looking at a younger African-American woman, but you know, obviously Biden doesn't call me to ask for his advice. I think we will see a woman. And I think that, you know, the Senator Kamala Harris from California is a front runner, I would think, as well as Stacey Abrams, who lost by a whisker the governorship of Georgia. And then there is a former police chief who is now a congresswoman from Orlando, whose name I couldn't call if you had a gun to my head. But she may be one of the front runners, I think.
That's Val Jennings, I believe. But
there you go.
Susan Rice is also a possibility. Maybe even Michelle Obama. Maybe even Oprah Winfrey. 877-217-5757. We're going to return. Much to talk about. Catch up with from Mark Ballard at the Capitol after this pause for the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief, is with us. And Governor John Bel Edwards rejected a state workers' raise delay, $57 million on the table for salary hikes. The governor says they will take place, and he is the governor of Louisiana. Some people are not happy about this, but it looks like the governor has won the day. What do you think, Mark Ballard?
Well, what happened was he used his line item veto to veto the use of the money that the legislature had put in, which was basically they were wanting to hold it until the fall and to see how things went. But he's the governor, and he used his constitutional power to do. I mean, that's part of the way we have the system set up. Our state workers were working the entire time throughout the virus, and we were depending on them during that time as a lot of people started turning to government for the services that they provide. And so, I mean, I think it was reasonable that he did what he did. You know, it was the Republican legislature's arguments about holding off was also reasonable, but that's what our whole democracy is all about.
Heather Cloud, Turkey Creek Republican, who I happened to run into yesterday, said, "We appreciate so much everything that our state employees do for us, but they haven't lost a paycheck. It would be really bad to offer up pay raises when families are suffering out there." The same Senator Cloud, who was with Bodie White, by the way, she's not happy that the governor vetoed her bill regarding lawyer advertising. This would have allowed the attorney general to have some say on verbiage in these ads. She said that it meant that if a settlement was $1 million and $500,000 of it was used for lawyer fees and investigations and medical bills and all that, that they couldn't say $1 million, they'd have to say $500,000. She said the governor should have signed that bill, but the governor said no. What do you think?
Well, I think he did sign a bill that was said exactly that, that was filed and passed. It was filed by Senator Connick of the West Bank in New Orleans. And the key differences between the bills, because his bill also says the same thing about having to put the net of what these settlements or jury verdicts are, meaning that you have to tell what the lawyer was paid. And so that's law. That's been signed. The key difference was that Senator Cloud's bill was followed a conservative group called ALEC that does legislation for conservatives, and it put the power in the hands of the attorney general. The power had always been in the hands of the Supreme Court, and it remains in the hands of the Supreme Court under the Connick's bill. So those were the two key things. It wasn't so much that they were going to conscript the legal advertising as much as who is going to be in charge of it. And also the ALEC legislation has been challenged in almost every state that it's been passed. And so whereas Connick's bill is kind of weaves through some of those First Amendment rights that lawyers have, just the same as Walmart and the insurance companies have, to, you know, sell their goods and or their services anyway. And so, I mean, she was a little disingenuous in that arguing that he didn't sign that part of the bill, but he had signed that part of the bill.
All right, so another bill does essentially the same thing, just doesn't give Jeff Landry the power.
It keeps it with the Supreme Court.
Okay. Well, she claims three members of the Supreme Court wanted her bill to be accepted, but as we know, the Supreme Court has seven members on it. Now, the governor also jettisoned a legislative plan to give Treasurer John Schroeder $7 million to divvy up among local governments, money that, according to Melinda Dillard in her AP story today, there was no explanation of how it would be spent. So I don't imagine John Schroeder, who already wasn't feeling warm and fuzzy about this governor, I don't imagine he's very happy about this.
Yeah, we haven't heard from him yet, but I think that we can all presume what he might be saying on this.
And the go ahead.
No, and the $7 million that basically Schroeder had not lined out. He said he was going to give it to locals, but he hasn't really lined out a procedure for doing so, whereas the state government already has a procedure for giving money and grants to local governments.
The governor did sign a $34 billion state operating budget. He took out $2 million for the state fire marshal's office to buy new equipment or make major repairs, saying the agency didn't request the money and the state can't afford it. 877-217-5757. Tracy at the Capitol says, do we have the tape from Representative Danny McCormick, Republican from Oil City, about equating mask mandates to the Holocaust? I think Matt Doyle, our ace producer, has unearthed the tape from Danny McCormick. Here we go.
Masks aren't bad. Mask mandates are. As many of you know, the city of Shreveport has announced an emergency order making masks mandatory. The Constitution is being shredded before our very eyes. Your body is your private property. If the government has the power to force you to wear a mask, they can force you to stick a needle in your arm against your will. They can put a microchip in you. They can even make you take the mark. After all, it's for the greater good.
The government needed a villain. People who don't wear a mask will be soon painted as the enemy, just as they did the Jews in Nazi Germany.
All right, that's... oh, my goodness. Is that your phone? That's Mr. McCormick, the astute lawmaker from Oil City. Mark Ballard, he sounds a lot, he sounds even farther out of his tree than John Milkovich did on his bad days.
Well, he's one of our more conservative members, and he was the guy that organized the one of the protests outside the governor's mansion for against wearing masks and some of the stay-at-home orders as well. So he's vocal about his particular partisan views.
Well, this in any crisis, the people on the fringe often get time, and in this case, Representative McCormick is getting his time. And when you say something that outlandish and you're doing so from a public platform, it deserves to be heard, and people deserve the right to make judgments. And I'm sure most of the judgments are not very favorable toward Representative McCormick. The state is right now facing this big spike in COVID-19. The governor has been very measured in his response, but even that, as we have noted, has received some pushback from the Republican majority in the legislature. They thought he should have opened this up long ago and far away, and now it appears that maybe going to phase two was a mistake. What do you think of where this is right now, Mark?
Well, I think it's become, rather than a health issue, it's become a partisan political issue. We see the president saying he wants the schools reopened or he's going to start withholding money, you know, and so, Even though health officials in his own administration are saying, no, that would be wrong to do. And I think the people have grown tired, weary of all of this stay at home and wearing masks and all of that sort of stuff. And they're, you know, it becomes a political issue when people are kind of weary of things.
877-217-5757 in our remaining time with Mark Ballard. And there's also this dispute. Senator Cleo Fields had a bill. I think it actually passed. The governor sitting on the governor's desk to stop athletic events at the high school level throughout the year, through the end of the year. But the Louisiana High School Athletic Association says it remains committed to business as usual this coming football season. Mark, who's going to win this one?
That is going to be a touchy issue. Bessie says that it has the authority to recommend to the schools whether or not they hold sporting events. And basically, the individual school districts are the decision makers in this, and we've yet to hear from what they have to say.
877-217-5757 is your number. Stuart in St. George, you're on with Mark Ballard. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, I just wanted to say that the Republican Party's dangerous, as you noted earlier, the Republican Party's dangerous trend of anti-science propositions began long ago after Newt Gingrich actually, put everything in terms of partisanship and polarization. And the Republican Party's trend towards anti-science kind of began with him and how he would disregard anything that was inconvenient for him politically. So I think you can connect all of these things together with Newt Gingrich and how the modern Republican Party became so dangerous to the American political system.
All right. What about Gingrich and how he came about?
Well, I would disagree in that we've always had these attacks. I mean, they go back to, we learned about Sally Hemings because of political attacks against Thomas Jefferson. So they've always been there. What Gingrich was able to do was to kind of popularize it as he did when he was in charge of this of the Republican Party, and creating those issues which made people queasy and turning them into anger issues, which would allow for an energizing the base, basically, to send money and to vote on certain particular issues without looking at other particular issues. And they've done that very well. And I think that we end up with the situation that we are now is the step-by-step a culmination of that type of strategy.
All right, we're going to wrap it up with Mark Ballard and then hear from Rodnina Hart at the Capitol Park Museum after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We're wrapping it up with Mark Ballard of The Advocate. The measure from Cleo Fields, he also sent a letter, by the way. It was a resolution, not a bill, so it does not have the power of law, but it urges and requests the State Board of Elementary and Secondary Education to adopt rules relative to the use of school property and personnel for athletic activities during the 2020-2021 school year to ensure Centers for Disease Control and state health guidelines are implemented to protect the health and safety of students, coaches, and spectators. And the governor is a huge athletic supporter, and he would like to see the games go on, and any implications involving secondary education, high school, that has an effect on what happens at the college level. So my guess is that they're not going to stop the games at the prep level, Mark, because it would mean that perhaps we would not be, we would be hypocritical to be playing games at the collegiate level.
Well, that certainly makes sense. I have a feeling this is going to be a lot tougher decision than we're giving credit for, because there is the health and safety issue that's involved here, and it's going against the feeling that we need to go back to normal as quick as possible. And sports in Louisiana is back to normal, and certainly that's what I want to do on my Saturday nights this fall. And so, well, but on the other hand, I also don't want to go out you know, with 100,000 of my favorite friends and catch coronavirus, or go to a high school game with 20,000 of my favorite friends and catch coronavirus. So
there you go. Mark, be safe, and happy birthday to your beautiful bride, Donna Britt, who turns 62 tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yeah.
Tomorrow, so.
It's a birthday festival.
Best to you and Donna. Thank you, Mark.
Okay, thank you much.
Bye-bye. Rodnina Hart is with us. She's division director at the Capitol Park Museum, one of the real treasures in Baton Rouge, right downtown. Open for business, right?
Absolutely, yes.
So you're there, and you greet all of comers, and and you've got a big exhibit right now.
Yes, we do. We're really excited about our Fonville Winans exhibition that will be opening on the 14th. We are putting on the finishing touches as we speak, so it's something to look forward to.
Well, Fonville Winans is truly a Louisiana treasure, no doubt about it, and his work is fabulous. It's immense, too. How much of his work do you have?
So we have one of the largest collections of his work. This exhibition has actually been about 30 years in the making. We have gotten about 160 photographs, and even more artifacts from his studio and his signature bicycle.
His signature bicycle.
Yes, yes. A lot of people may know that he was an avid bicyclist here in Baton Rouge, and even was integral in starting the bike clubs here.
He was probably carrying all that equipment with him on the bicycle, too.
Probably so.
And as we know, in the old days, it took a lot of equipment. It's a little different now, but
yes,
there are people who still do it the old-fashioned way, like C.C. Lockwood. Mm-hmm. His work is different from others, and that's, and of course, black and white,
yes.
Which I think has more power than color.
Yes. Oh, the exhibition is even titled Colorful World in Black and White. And the fact that he was able to really capture the humanity in his subject matter. And we span his entire career, starting with the work that he did when he was a young man in South Louisiana. And none of that was commissioned work. It was all him having an adventure and kind of capturing the people of that story. So a lot of representation from Avery Island, from Crowley, East Feliciana, also a few photographs from Angola, from all of that series of him being young. And then in 1936, he moved to Baton Rouge with his wife, and he worked for the state for a little while as their photographer for a lot of the politicians. And then after that stint, he opened his own studio right downtown on Laurel Street, and was able to do beautiful portraiture and lots of brides. And so we get to have all of that in our exhibition.
Well, I know Cyril Vedder has kept the Theodore Fonville Winans flame alive, as have many others.
Absolutely.
Great photographer, born in Missouri, came to Louisiana, you said, when he was, what, about 25?
Mm-hmm.
Black and white images documented South Louisiana people and places. I think he started as a wedding photographer, and of course we know the rest is
Absolutely.
History. He's rugged outdoors, fishermen, swamp dwellers, and a portion of his work is stored in Hill Memorial Library. Is any of that
Yes.
at your exhibit?
Well, we collaborated with them to get some excerpts from those early adventures, the cruise of the Pentail. So he got this really cool boat. It was a secondhand boat, and he was able to travel through South Louisiana in that boat, and he made a video. And he would share the video for, I think, a quarter for, or maybe 5 cents for students.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so we are working with the Hill Memorial to show excerpts from the video.
Well, the exhibit runs from when to when?
Well, it starts on the 14th, and we're having an opening reception. Of course, in COVID world, we are being extra cautious. We're limiting the number of people who can come inside at a time. We're sanitizing all surfaces. Masks are required, as they are throughout all of Baton Rouge. And most of the remarks and things of that nature, music, food trucks, that's all outside. So inside is just where the art is, and we hope to draw a nice crowd.
That's on the 14th?
On the 14th from 5 to 7 p.m.
On Bastille Day.
On Bastille Day, yes. Someone else noted that.
Fonville Winans, Louisiana Politics, People, and Places. That's the book a listener asks.
Yes.
From Cyril Vedder.
Yes.
The foreword, by the way, was written by James Carville, and it also had some remarks from the aforementioned C.C. Lockwood. But his place in history is secure, but his work should be celebrated at any time. He was truly one of a kind, and he was one of us. He was a treasure.
Absolutely. And we're really fortunate that we've been able to talk with Bob Winans, his son, who he helped a lot with the collection and giving us a little bit of insight. And also Stephen Kleinpeter, who's a local photography developer. And he's been really great. People have really come out of the woodworks. We even had a local photographer, Jen Aachen, who has come and she's supported the exhibition. So, you know, it's been a great way of bringing the community together around photography. And he's such a beloved figure. He photographed many of the people in our community. So it's going to be a real... kind of a homecoming for lots of folks in the city.
Holly notes that Fonville did ride his bicycle in later years and hosted Sunday brunch bicycle tours of the city.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Died September 13th, 1992, almost 28 years, but his legacy remains secure. And for those unfamiliar with the Capitol Park Museum, where Rodney Nahart is in charge, it is a treasure, and it is open... every day of the year, almost.
At least
you can go by there at any time of the year, and it's always a place where you'll find something special.
Absolutely, yeah. We're open 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. We changed our hours. We sell the last ticket at 3:30, but it's just so that we can sanitize the building and give us a little more time.
Another listener asked about your opening on the 14th,
yes.
For those who would like to attend that.
It is free and open to the public, and we'd love for as many people
at
who would
time?
Like to come to please be in attendance.
What time?
It's from 5 to 7 p.m.
On the 14th.
On the 14th, yes.
Which will be next Tuesday.
Exactly.
5 to 7 p.m.
Yes, so come on by after work.
You'll see the remarkable Rodney Nahart. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And before we go, I know James in Metairie's been waiting, and I don't know if he's talking about Fonville or something else, but he's always talking about something important when James calls. James, what's on your mind?
Well, thank you for that, Jim. Some breaking news this morning. Our celebrity KKK leader, former Grand Wizard David Duke, has now officially endorsed his president, our president, Donald Trump, and Tucker Carlson for vice president. So that's, I guess, no surprise, but... Tucker Carlson's profile in the political world, I guess, is going up in the eyes of many. Jeff, I mean, Jim, you mentioned about State Representative Danny McCormick. I heard him interviewed yesterday on another station, and he professes to be pro-life, yet he's a fanatical anti-masker. I wish the governor, you know, the governor during the campaign talked about expanding Medicaid as being a pro-life measure. Maybe the governor could tell the people, and there are a lot of resistors, these anti-maskers. I see them all over town down here, especially in Metairie.
Well, James, thank you for your thoughts as always. By the way, Tucker Carlson tore into Tammy Duckworth, decorated war veteran who lost limbs in battle. And for him, Tucker Carlson, to latch on to President Trump, who is the world's biggest draft dodger, who avoided war and attacking somebody, and also attacked her ethnicity, by the way. Shame on Tucker Carlson. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Great to have you with us. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.